Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Thursday, the 19th of March. Today, with unemployment topping 2 million after the steepest monthly rise in the number of claimants on record, how bad is the recession going to get?
I think it's going to be the worst year for growth that we've seen since 1945. And 1945 obviously was the year when the war ended.
Also today, Joseph Fritzl is due to be sentenced after his shock admission that he caused the death of one of the seven children he fathered with his daughter.
He could get life imprisonment for that, but he could get as little as 20 years.
And how the recession is affecting Labour's voters in the party's heartlands.
At a time when we were doing well, the money should have been invested a lot better than it has been, and that there was a lot of greedy speculators out there.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Sandy Waugh with the news headlines and the papers.
The actress Natasha Richardson has died in a New York hospital at the age of 45. She'd never recovered after a fall while skiing in Canada. At her bedside were her husband, the actor Liam Neeson, her two sons, and her mother, the actress Vanessa Redgrave. She was part of the Redgrave acting dynasty. Her father was director Tony Richardson, who died young himself. She starred in both films and television, but first made her name on the British stage. There'll be a second nationwide strike in France today, calling for more government action to support workers during the recession and to protect jobs. It's expected to involve hundreds of thousands in 200 towns and cities. The president said he didn't plan any further action to help the economy, while unions have called on him to stop all public sector job cuts. Unemployment in France is expected to reach 10% this year. Here in Britain, unemployed construction workers will stage another demonstration to demand fair access to jobs, which they say are going to foreign workers. They've already been demonstrating outside the Grain Power Station construction site. They claim two Polish subcontracting firms are refusing applications from British labourers. Today they'll protest outside a Chatham job centre. In Washington, the head of the insurance company AIG has told members of Congress that some of his company executives have begun returning bonus payments. They were awarded the payments after the company was saved from collapse by a government bailout. We'll have the full story later in Guardian Daily. Also in the USA, a man's been convicted of murdering five firefighters when he deliberately started wildfires in Southern California in 2006. Raymond Lee Euler, a mechanic, started the fires in Riverside County during a drought. Five firefighters died fighting them. Juries recommended the death penalty. There are several pictures of Natasha Richardson's family in the morning papers. Redgrave Family Vigil, the Telegraph headlines it, over a shot of Mother Vanessa. Jolie's grief, says the Mirror, above a view of Natasha's actress sister Jolie in tears. The Sun suggests she thought her marriage to Liam Neeson was cursed after he nearly died in a motorcycle accident. A couple of papers lead with yesterday's British unemployment figures, which have once again risen above 2 million, as The Express points out. It goes on to say that migrants still queue to reach Benefit Britain, with a picture of a job centre in Portsmouth alongside one of migrants at Calais docks. The Times chooses a different angle to get angry about. It says public sector shielded as unemployment reaches 2 million, claiming there's a growing gap in both pay and jobs between public and private sectors. The Financial Times focuses, as you'd expect, on FSA Chief Lord Turner's plan to end cities' light touch regulation. The Telegraph says all men over 50 could be tested for prostate cancer in a new international study. And The Guardian lead reads MI5 faces new rules on terror interrogations, saying the government bowed to increasing public pressure yesterday after suggestions of British complicity in torture. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The number of people out of work and claiming benefit rose by 138,000 in February. That's a record leap in the claimant count. The number of people out of work now tops 2 million. David Blanchflower, the economics professor and member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, says Britain will carry the scar of unemployment for years to come. The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, said the figures were a bombshell.
In every recession, you get a steady increase in unemployment to a peak, but this peak is higher than in either of the last two recessions that we've had in the UK. So the worst previous monthly increase in claimant count unemployment in the UK was 118,000 in early 1991. The most recent set for February this year are 138,400 increase. I mean, that is a stupendous number of people to lose their jobs in a single month, worst we've ever seen.
and clear evidence, if any were needed, of how these problems in the financial markets that we saw last year have now had an impact on the real economy and on real people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody really 18 months ago thought that when we started to get news of problems with banks with their sort of weird derivative trades and so on, that it would have this sort of impact on the real economy. But actually, what we've seen was a sort of gradual increase in unemployment as the economy slowed during 2008. But once the big trauma hit the financial sector last September and October, when the collapse of Lehman Brothers sparked a sort of crisis across the entire global financial system, we've seen economic growth nosedive and job losses have gone up very, very substantially, not just here, but across the world.
A grim forecast from the International Monetary Fund on the contraction of the global economy, and they said it's going to be particularly bad for Britain. How bad is it going to get?
Well, I think it's going to be the worst year for growth that we've seen since 1945. And 1945 obviously was the year when the war ended, but was quite exceptional. But this is going to be the worst single year fall in output that we have seen since then. And we've had some pretty bad periods, 74, 75, 80, 81, 91. They were all years of falling output. This is going to be somewhere in the region of 3.5% to 4% drop in national output, which is a staggeringly big fall.
And as far as options for the government, I mean, interest rates are at a record low. They've begun the process of quantitative easing. That's creating fresh money. What else can they do?
Well, they'll create a bit more money. Obviously, there's going to be pressure on the Bank of England to step up that process. So they've announced they'll go up to $75 billion in the first tranche, but they've asked for permission ultimately to do £150 billion worth of quantitative easing. I think they'll go the full £150 billion hog there. I think there will be... there's a limit to what else they can do on the macroeconomic side, on the big picture side, because as you say, short-term interest rates are already rock bottom. The budget deficit has been allowed to expand very substantially. There'll be some measures in the budget, I'm sure. I think what will happen is there'll be a bit more easing of policy on April the 22nd, probably a bit more public spending, bringing forward investment programmes. I think the government will be under pressure, I think, to actually have some sort of strategy for putting people back into jobs. It's put money into job centres to help people back into work. What it probably needs to do is act on the demand side of the economy, create demand for work. That might mean through subsidies to employers to keep people in work rather than to get rid of them, or it might mean more ambitiously some form of industrial strategy whereby a lot of the money that's been created could be used to develop new industries in some of the sort of high-tech sectors, environmental technologies, biotechnology, some of the sectors where Britain can use its sort of expertise in science to develop new industries to take the place of some of those that are really struggling.
And Lord Turner, the chairman of the Financial Services Authority, unveils what he describes as a revolution in banking regulation. Are his changes enough to stop a future crisis of the sort that we've seen?
Well, they're certainly quite tough measures, I think. I mean, some of the changes, such as making banks have more capital at all times and with the discretion to increase that during boom times, would actually have quite a substantial impact on what... on how banks behave. And I think that going forward, there will be constraints on the potential expansion and growth of the financial sector in the UK, and attempt to make the economy a bit more balanced between the financial sectors and all other sectors of the economy. And I think today's unemployment figures are going to really mean that process, the Turner Review, is just the start of a process, because quite clearly an awful lot of people are now losing their jobs through no fault of their own, and there is going to be a very substantial political backlash against the people responsible for this crisis. This is not, if you break down the unemployment figures, this is not a crisis which is just in the City of London or even in the South East. Job losses are across the entire economy, in every region, in every industry, in every age group. And those people are going to be justifiably very angry with the people who've caused this. And that the political consequence of that, I believe, will be that there's going to be immense political pressure on all parties to make sure or make sure as far as they can that this never happens again. That means much tougher, inevitably much tougher regulation of the financial sector. So the Turner Review, I think, is not the last word in this. It is quite a big deal, but I don't think we've heard the last of the political backlash against the city and the financial sector more generally.
Larry Elliott, and there's full coverage of the unemployment statistics today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, Battlestar Galactica is as good as The Wire, but no one takes it seriously because there's spaceships in it. That's the considered opinion of Richard Vine. Read what he says, guardian.co.uk/G2. A doctor writes about Stafford Hospital, the subject of the most damning report ever on an NHS hospital, at guardian.co.uk/health. And John Crone, he's the 14-year-old wonder kid of American conservatism. He's interviewed by Ed Pilkington at guardian.co.uk/America. Joseph Fritzl, the Austrian man who held his daughter Elizabeth captive in an underground prison for 24 years, is sentenced today. Yesterday, he admitted he caused the death of a baby, one of the seven children he fathered with her in the cellar. The 73-year-old pleaded guilty to negligent homicide and enslavement. He'd already admitted incest, rape, coercion and false imprisonment. Kate Connolly is in St Poulton. She says Fritzl is likely to spend the rest of his life in jail.
He's obviously pleaded guilty now to the charge of the negligence on his part led to the death of his son. And if the court upholds that, then he could get life imprisonment for that, but he could get as little as 20 years. And what we understand from a psychiatrist who gave an expert testimony yesterday, she recommended that he should go to a psychiatric institute. She said that he needed lengthy therapy, and that was the only way to ensure that he could be healed of a personality disorder that she said he suffered from.
A very dramatic day yesterday, the third day of the trial, when Joseph Fritzl changed his pleas and admitted all the charges.
That's right. We all filed into court yesterday morning, not expecting what happened, which was that the judge told him to sit in the witness box and said to him, did he have anything to say, following on from the very traumatic and harrowing video testimony that they had shown delivered by his daughter to the court the day before. And he said that, yes, indeed, he did. He would like to now plead guilty to all the charges. And the judge then tried to understand why he was changing his mind. And he said that having seen the video testimony, he had gone back to his prison cell that night. And that had really made him realize for the first time how cruel he had been towards his daughter. And this came as a complete surprise to everyone in court, including his lawyer. I spoke to him afterwards and he said that he had not expected Mr. Fritzl to plead guilty to all the charges.
And there were reports that his daughter, Elizabeth, was in court to see Fritzl's reaction to her video evidence.
Yes, some very intriguing reports. The local newspaper Courier, in particular, reporting that she was in court. All his lawyer would say was that that there were people in the public gallery. The only people who would have been allowed in the public gallery in the session, which was being held in camera, would have been victims. Each victim allowed three people to accompany them. So it is possible, we believe, that she might have well been in court to see her father, as it were, see her give evidence.
And perhaps in a sign of what was to come, it was the first time yesterday that Fritzl arrived at the courtroom without covering his face with a blue folder.
That's right. It was almost as if he thought, well, this is it. I'm letting my guard drop now. This is the end of the road for me. That was the very, very strong feeling that we had. Very surprised to see him come in, expecting him to be covering his face with that blue folder that has sort of become a symbol of this trial. Instead, we had an ashen-faced man with his typical wiry hair and his characteristic high eyebrows walking into court, shuffling into court, flanked by several police officers. And he also listened quite impassively as the psychiatrist gave her expert evidence.
Kate Connolly. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the Brazilian writer Paulo Coelho talks to The Guardian.
Is it true that you wrote it in 4 weeks? 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yes. Yes, it is true, meaning that somehow the book was already written in my soul.
But first, yesterday a Guardian ICM poll showed the Conservatives holding on to a 12-point lead over Labour. But there were signs that if Gordon Brown's government can pull Britain out of the recession, Labour could give the Tories a run for their money in the next election. The Guardian's Michael White went to Bramley in West Leeds, where Labour have a majority of almost 13,000. To find out how the credit crunch was affecting Labour's vote, he went to a church hall for the annual meeting of the local debt forum. He asked the local MP, John Battle, whether Labour was doing enough to combat the recession.
I think I'd turn the economics upside down, and as well as saying we have a fiscal stimulus that builds buildings and provides assets, schools and hospitals, as well as that, I think we should pay people who may not be paid at the moment but doing work, and those on low pay. So if I were to be provocative about it, I think in Leeds I'd employ 1,000 home helps and carers, pay them, even part-time pay them.
To look after old people and disabled people to look and after, children.
Absolutely, in the neighbourhood, in their communities, give them an income for doing the work that in the long term will save the social services and the healthcare budget. The new job generator is service employment. Let's go for that now and save the money in the long term by putting money into the poorest pockets, because they will spend it now on things they need. That will be the real fiscal stimulus in the shops, in the communities where we live. We've tried the top-down, trickle-down theory that the rich will help us out by getting even richer and then letting some of it drop down on us. It's never reached the parts it's supposed to reach, so let's try from completely the opposite direction. Start with the poor, locally and, dare I add, internationally, and see what a difference that would make. But that might be a social economy, not a situation we've had in the past.
Right, well, we've left West Leeds now. We've come into Leeds city centre. Leeds' population of 750,000 has got the second largest financial services industry in Britain outside London. It was far more successful than some of its former industrial rivals in reviving itself in a post-industrial way over the last 20, 25 years. The city centre is much spruced up, and there's a lot of fancy new shoppings, a lot of new retail, a lot of pubs all over the city, former banks and former industrial buildings of all sites, and of course there's a lot of new build, a lot of buy-to-let flats in the centre of Leeds. Now we're going to stop and just ask a few voters, lunchtime, scurrying around their business, what they think of the government and what they think ought to be done about it, and I suspect we'll get some mixed replies. Which party do you normally vote for?
Past Labour.
So you're an ex-Labour voter? You wouldn't vote Labour next time, is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't to the next election, no.
Is that about the recession or about Gordon Brown, or they're just that time for a change?
The recession and Gordon Brown, really.
There's just an air of doom and gloom with the economy at the moment in Europe, really. I find it not just Ireland and England, but
who's to blame, the bankers or the government?
I think both really are responsible. I mean, you know, we had good times, and really, at a time when we were doing well, the money should have been invested a lot better than it has been, and that there was a lot of greedy speculators out there, and you know, chance of some quick money to be made, and I think that's really where it all stems from.
We've bumped into a veteran Labour activist called Arthur Giles, who has views on these things, and I'm just going to have a few words with him.
We're fighting elections now.
The local election, this is the by-election on the other side of the city, or do you mean...
We're fighting that, but we're fighting local elections and the general election now. Mm. We fight all the time. We leaflet all the time, we knock on doors all the time. Not just when there's a by-election. In our own constituency of Putsey, which you've come to visit, that's exactly what we're doing. And I was only leafleting yesterday.
And Putsey's next door, and it's the sort of seat you could lose, isn't it?
Yes.
The Tories have got their eye on Putsey.
Indeed it is, and it's seen as a very important seat. For us.
You're knocking on the door in Putsey at the moment with people who are known to be Labour supporters in the past, what's the reaction like? What are they saying?
We're surprised, to be honest, because they're fairly consistent in terms of wanting to continue to support us. I mean, we put a as I said, we've been putting leaflets out, and quite recently we attached a kind of questionnaire to our leaflet. And we got a large number of returns. And of those, at least 97% weren't necessarily in favour, but weren't against.
Well, having talked to people in Leeds and talked to plenty of other people, officials and voters and activists and others, critical and friendly of the Labour government, what you get here is a mixed reaction. Some people are saying, well, it's very difficult all over the world. Ordinary voters saying, in all countries it's difficult. I wouldn't be in Mr. Obama's shoes for the world, they say. So it's difficult for Gordon Brown. I think he's doing his best. Other people say, time for a change. Brown's hopeless. He doesn't listen to the people. Let's have a general election tomorrow. And yet again, there's a third category which says, well, we're not very keen on the Labour government. They've been in long enough, but not all that enthusiastic about David Cameron either. And some of my friends in the media here say, Tories doing pretty well in Yorkshire generally. William Hague has got stuck in there and organised them. They're even being allowed to keep the money they raise, not having to send it south to London. But they haven't really cracked Leeds.
Michael White reporting from Leeds. And there's more on the challenges facing Labour this week at guardian.co.uk/politics. In the United States, there's growing anger over the $165 million paid last week in bonuses to seven executives of the insurer AIG. This was after the federal government had bailed out AIG, which lost $100 billion last year. The issue's threatening to bring to an abrupt end President Obama's honeymoon. Edward Liddy, AIG's chief executive, received a grilling yesterday from US Congress, as Daniel Nassau reports from Washington.
It began with the congressman taking turns denouncing AIG and describing the company's behavior as distasteful and objectionable and saying that they were determined somehow or other to get the money back.
Let's exercise our ownership rights and let's bring a lawsuit as the owners against people who in fact did damage to the company.
We continue to play kind of a game that children used to play, pin the tail on the donkey.
There's a tidal wave of rage, and it's building up, and it's expressing itself at this latest outrage, which is really just the tip of the iceberg.
As far as the American people are concerned, I think AIG now stands for arrogance, incompetence, and greed.
After a brief pause so the congressman could return to the House floor to take some votes, the main event began when Edward Liddy, the government-appointed chief executive and chairman of AIG, walked into the lion's den to face the congressman. He began with an announcement.
This morning, I've asked the employees of AIG Financial Products to step up and do the right thing. Specifically, I've asked those who receive retention payments in excess of $100,000 or more to return at least half of those payments. Some have already stepped forward and offered to give up 100% of their payments.
Liddy is a former chief executive of Allstate, which is another giant American insurance company, and he came out of retirement at the behest of the federal government in September after the $170 billion taxpayer takeover of the company. For all of his grief, he is being paid $1. He's accepted $1 in annual salary.
I'm trying desperately to prevent an uncontrolled collapse of that business. This is the only way to improve AIG's ability to pay taxpayers back quickly and completely.
Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts demanded to see a list of bonus recipients, and Liddy said that he would resist the move for fear for the safety of his employees, some of whom have been threatened with death.
All the executives and their families should be executed with piano wire around their necks. I'm looking for all the CEO's names, kids, where they live, etc. You have a legitimate request.
Well,
I want to protect the well-being of our employees.
There was also a bit of excitement when a group of protesters clad in pink were scolded by the congressman and told that if they did not take down their signs, they would be ejected.
I think you've tried my patience now. The pink ladies, the signs are either going to be removed from the room or you're going to be removed from the room before I recognize another speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given your method of dealing with this, I assume it's a good thing no one was wearing a T-shirt with this slogan.
This hearing will do little to change people's minds about this. The public, for certain, but also the president and the Congress have made it clear they intend to get this money back. And Liddy can protest as much as he wants that it wasn't his doing, but right now he is a focus of public anger.
Daniel Nassau. Now, exciting news in the world of social networks. You can now follow Guardian Daily, that's this very podcast, on Twitter. I'll be posting the latest updates as we put the podcast together. Sign up and tell us what you think. twitter.com/Guardian Daily. The Brazilian writer Paulo Coelho is about to publish his 12th novel, The Winner Stands Alone. He's best known for The Alchemist, a novel that put him in the Guinness Book of Records. It's been translated into more languages than a book by any other living author. Coelho spoke to The Guardian's Hannah Poole.
Altogether, my book sold over 115 million copies, not counting the Paris editions, that you can add another 20%. Basically in South America, India, Middle East, as for pirate editions. And The Alchemist, yes, we calculate that it is around 35 million copies.
Is it true that you wrote it in 4 weeks?
2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yes. Yes, it is true, meaning that somehow the book was already written in my soul. Why did I take so long to start writing? Because I was 40 by then. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to write a biography, something like this, autobiography. But at first, it was too early to write autobiography. And second, I thought that I could understand myself better if I would write a metaphor.
I read, I was reading all the pre-interviews and stuff, and you've spoken before about your upbringing. And the time when you were 17 and when your parents had you committed to an asylum.
Yeah, 3 times. And also I was in jail 3 times. Well, I never saw myself as a victim. This is part of my journey. I could, yes, see myself as a victim and say, oh my God, this world is not fair. God is not fair. I'm trying to do my best. The simple fact that I don't accept my parents' dreams, so to say, because they want me to follow their dreams, not my dreams, does not make me a criminal or an outcast. But then I said, okay, I was too young to think about it, but I thought, well, this is life. And
because both of those experiences would again be something that could make somebody very angry and very politicized.
Well, I would say that the jail experience did not make me angry, it made me scared that it is worse. You know, when you are angry, you react. When you're scared, you don't react. You just accept. And it took me many years to overcome this fear. But time heals everything. Love included.
Yeah, your newest novel. Yeah. You describe it at the start as being a stark portrait of where we are now.
Yeah. I was very surprised because I wrote this book 1 year ago. In February, before all this collapse. But I was asking to myself about this cult of celebrity and luxury and how people want to be different, but not in the good sense, not by following their dreams, but by buying things that will make they look different. They may look different, but they are not different. So, and then you see invisible superclass manipulating the whole system. And I wrote this book. It was published in Brazil, very successful, and all of a sudden, the world collapsed.
Paulo Coelho's latest novel, The Winner Stands Alone, is published by HarperCollins. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.